This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Oh, hello. I was just working on a multi-million-dollar lawsuit for one of my clients. I know what you're thinking. Yeah, a lawsuit sounds good, Saul, but who can I sue? Who can you sue? Try police departments, libraries, construction companies, school officials, cleaning services, financial institutions, local and international, your neighbors, your family members, your church, synagogue, or other religious institution, your employers.
That's an ad for Saul Goodman, the attorney who took whatever work he could get, from slip and fall cases and frivolous lawsuits to clients like meth cooker and dealer Walter White, the central character on the brilliant AMC series Breaking Bad. Luckily for Breaking Bad fans, Saul Goodman is back in the new Breaking Bad prequel, Better Call Saul. We're going to listen to the interview Terry Gross recorded earlier this week with Peter Gould, who created the character of Saul Goodman when Gould was a writer on Breaking Bad. Gould co-created Better Call Saul with Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad. Also in the studio is Jonathan Banks, the actor who played hitman and fixer Mike Ehrmantraut on Breaking Bad. Better Call Saul fans who are up to date with the show know that the most recent episode revealed some of Mike's backstory. It's important to note that Terry spoke with Jonathan Banks before that episode had been shown, so they won't address that latest development. Let's start with a scene from the first episode of Better Call Saul, which is set 6 years before the start of Breaking Bad. Saul Goodman isn't using that name yet. He's still going by his given name, Jimmy McGill. He's a public defender who's so broke, his home and office are housed in the back room of a nail salon. He's trying to get some wealthy, high-profile clients for his private practice. When he finds out that the county treasurer is suspected of having embezzled over $1.5 million, Saul, played by Bob Odenkirk, sets his sights on becoming the treasurer's lawyer. Saul can't invite clients to his shabby office, so he meets with the treasurer and the treasurer's wife at a restaurant.
Look, all I know is what I read in the paper. And typically, when money goes missing from the county treasury, and the number here is $1.6 million...
Well, that's an accounting discrepancy.
It's a discrepancy, absolutely. But typically, when that happens, the police look at the treasurer. And since that person is... I just think a little proactivity may be in order.
Yeah, well, I just think I'd look guilty if I hired a lawyer.
No, actually, it's getting arrested that makes people look guilty, even the innocent ones. And innocent people get arrested every day. And they find themselves in a little room with a detective who acts like he's their best friend. Talk to me, he says. Help me clear this thing up. You don't need a lawyer. Only guilty people need lawyers. And boom, hey, that's when it all goes south. That's when you want someone in your corner, someone who will fight tooth and nail. Lawyers, you know, we're like health insurance. You hope you never need it, but man, oh man, not having it? No.
Peter Gould, Jonathan Banks, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on Better Call Saul. Peter Gould, let me start with you. Of all the characters to spin off, why did you want to spin off a series about Saul? I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did.
Well, I'm glad you're glad. It may sound like a calculated process, but there was nothing but organic instinct behind it. Saul Goodman was introduced in season two of Breaking Bad, and I was a little worried when he first appeared because he seemed maybe not in keeping with the rest of the tone of the show. But somehow he seemed to work in the world of Breaking Bad, and we loved him. Everybody in the writer's room enjoyed writing for him and thinking about what would happen to Saul Goodman. And it started becoming a writer's room joke that this is too silly to happen on Breaking Bad, or this is something that we'd like to happen on Breaking Bad, but it doesn't quite fit. So it'll go on the Saul Goodman show. And as the years went by, it became less of a joke. So the answer really is that this character, he took us by the collar and said, do this show, more than us deciding that he was the guy.
Bob Odenkirk said that he based his performance of Saul on Hollywood agents and the way that agents like try to manipulate their clients into deals. Who did you base Saul on? Were you thinking of agents? Were you thinking of lawyers?
I think we were thinking about lawyers. I grew up in New York, and I had some lawyers in the family, and none of them were as fast-talking as Saul Goodman. But there was always the sense that people were making their lives through their wits. And so it was just the idea of someone who is a free agent, who has the gift of the gab. And also, in mechanically, on Breaking Bad, we had this character of Walter White, who was so dark and had so little self-knowledge. And we needed a character who was a little bit more verbal, who was a little smoother, who was a little more comfortable in his own skin, just for contrast. And so in some ways, Saul Goodman was the flip side of Walter White.
Why don't we hear a scene from the final episode in Breaking Bad that the character of Saul is in? And at this point, the whole meth operation has blown up. Hank, the DEA agent and Walt's brother-in-law, is dead. There's no safe place for Walt or Saul to hide. So Saul's going into hiding, having paid $1 zillion to a guy who provides a new identity, a new fake papers, and a new place to live. And this guy is doing the same thing for Walt. Walt is so intent on revenge and killing a few guys who he wants to kill that there's no way he's going to turn himself in. But Walt insists he's not going to go underground, and then he starts telling Saul that Saul has to come with him. And Saul has no intention of going with Walt underground. He's going to go into his own hiding place. So here's Saul explaining to Walt there's no way he's going with him.
Hey, I'm a civilian. I'm not your lawyer anymore. I'm nobody's lawyer. The fun's over. From here on out, I'm Mr. Low Profile, just another douchebag with a job and three pairs of Dockers. If I'm lucky, a month from now, best case scenario, I'm managing a Cinnabon in Omaha.
You're still part of this, whether you like it or not.
I'm sorry, I don't think so.
Okay, that's from Season 5, Episode 15 of Breaking Bad, and my guest Peter Gould created the character of Saul and wrote that final episode that Saul is in. Lo and behold, at the very beginning of the new series, the prequel Better Call Saul, Saul is managing a Cinnabon in Omaha. So when you wrote that scene in Breaking Bad, did you think that would be the perfect starting off point if we do a prequel?
Not at all. That was something that came up in the writer's room pretty quickly. We finished Breaking Bad. We weren't really thinking about any kind of sequel or anything beyond. We were just, you know, by the skin of our teeth trying to finish the show. And in fact, I think that Cinnabon, I hate to reveal it, I don't even know if that was the original pitch of where he was going to go, but I always have felt that Cinnabon, something about that word amuses me and it makes me smile. So it just seemed like the right thing for him to say there. And lo and behold, we thought, why not deliver on the promise of that scene?
So you had to figure out how to get into this prequel. So it starts in the present where the character of Saul left off in Breaking Bad, and he's managing the Cinnabon in Omaha. He lives in a black and white world now. There's no glamour. He has no identity. He has no profile. And it's literally shot in black and white. And he goes home. He's lonely. There's like nothing to do but put on the TV. And he starts reminiscing. He takes an old videotape of one of his Better Call Saul commercials, pops it in the VCR, plays it back, and that brings us to the flashback. Can you describe how you thought of that as the doorway from the present into the past?
We really thought that we should see the consequences of all the fun. Jimmy McGill is a guy who makes a series of choices. Some of them are very understandable, and some of them are from his gut. And they lead to inexorably to one place, and that's the basement of the Disappearers. This is a guy who builds a character, Saul Goodman, and builds an empire of a kind, and then has it all pulled out from under him. And we thought, let's show this guy in his own private purgatory in Omaha, Nebraska, managing a Cinnabon. And it's not so much that working in a Cinnabon is a bad thing, but this guy has had his identity taken away from him. And I think the irony is this is someone who is a showman. He's someone who loves to have people looking at him. He loves attention. And there he is. He's anonymous. And that is painful. And I think it also makes you wonder, what was it all about? What's the point of this guy's life?
I'm talking with Peter Gould, who is the co-creator and co-showrunner of Better Call Saul, the new prequel from Breaking Bad. Peter Gould also wrote for Breaking Bad. Also with us is Jonathan Banks, who plays the character of Mike Ehrmantraut. And Mike was the hitman and fixer for Gus Fring, the drug kingpin, and then worked closely with Walt when Walt, after killing Gus, went independent. Things did not work out well between them. But let's play the very first scene that that the character of Mike Ehrmantraut is in. And Jesse's girlfriend, Jane, has OD'd in bed. Jesse wakes up to find her dead. He calls Walt. Walt calls Saul, the lawyer, and Saul sends Mike, the fixer. And Mike cleans up all the evidence of drugs and tells Jesse what to do. Here's the scene in which that happens.
Any other drugs in the house? Think hard. Your freedom depends on it. What about guns? You got any guns in the house? Here's your story. You woke up. You found her. That's all you know. Say it. Say it, please. I woke up. I found her. That's all I know. Say it. I woke up. I found her. That's all I know.
I woke up. I found her. That's all I know.
Again?
I woke up. I found her. That's all I know.
Again? Again?
I woke up. I found her. That's all I know. I woke up. I found her. That's all I know.
Once you call it in, the people who show up will be with the Office of Medical Investigations. That's primarily who you'll talk to. Police officers may arrive, they may not. Depends on how busy a morning they're having. Typically, ODs are not a high-priority call. There's nothing here to incriminate you, so I'd be amazed if you got placed under arrest. However, if you do, you say nothing. You tell them you just want your lawyer. Then you call Saul Goodman. Do I need to state the obvious? I was not here.
That's so great. And that's my guest, Jonathan Banks, as Mike Ehrmantraut. Jonathan Banks, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you, Terry.
So, you know, it was supposed to be Saul who cleans up things for Jesse and tells him what to say. So Peter Gould, it ended up being Mike. How did it end up being Mike?
Well, we were at the very end of season two, and there was this moment when Jesse woke up and Jane was dead, and we were going to have Saul Goodman come in and clean things up. And unfortunately, Bob was not available. Bob Odenkirk was not available to come to Albuquerque for that particular scene. And so very much at the last minute, Vince Gilligan had the inspiration of bringing in Mike, the fixer, or his private detective, who's been mentioned a couple of times on the show. And now we're going to see him. And through some miracle, we cast Mr. Jonathan Banks.
Jonathan Banks, what was the call? Did you get a call directly from Vince Gilligan?
No, they, Bialy Thomas, who are wonderful casting directors, I went in and I thought I was going to, you know, I thought I'd do a day's work and leave. And it snowed, and I went in, and that scene where you hear the slap is Aaron still complains about it. He didn't know it was coming. and I loved the boy. But, you know, it was fun. I had a good time. And, no, it came as a surprise. But you tell me if I'm wrong, Peter. But Peter and Tom Schnoz and Vince have been friends forever. And when they were kids in college, they used to watch Wise Guy. And so that, I guess my character on Wise Guy made an impression on them.
And Wise Guy was a great TV series that started in 1987 and introduced actors like Stanley Tucci and Kevin Spacey. At least that's where I found out about them. So you mentioned that Aaron Paul didn't know that you were going to slap him in that scene. Is that considered acceptable for you to do that?
It's totally acceptable for me. I'm not the one that got slapped.
The rules that apply to everybody else don't necessarily apply to Mr. Banks.
No, you know, I got that senior pass, you know. And so, you know, I mean, if you can't take a hit from an old guy, I mean, come on, Aaron can take a punch, for goodness sakes.
Goodbye, Walter.
You're welcome.
I'm sorry. What?
I want those names, Mike. You owe me that much.
I don't owe you a damn thing.
All of this, falling apart like this, is on you.
Wow.
Wow! Oh, that's some kind of logic right there, Mike. You screw up, get yourself followed by the DEA, and now suddenly this is all my fault. Why don't you walk me through this, Mike?
We had a good thing, you stupid son of a bitch. We had Fring. We had a lab. We had everything we needed. It all ran like clockwork. Oh, you could have shut your mouth, cooked, and made as much money as you ever needed. It was perfect. But no, you just had to blow it up. You and your pride and your ego. You just had to be the man. If you'd done your job, known your place, we'd all be fine right now.
And that was the sound of Walt killing Mike in cold blood, shooting him through the windshield. Great scene. And so that was Bryan Cranston and my guest, Jonathan Banks. And also with us is Peter Gould, who is the co-creator of Better Call Saul. So what was it like for you to be killed in cold blood by Walt and have your character die? And, you know, his car kind of crashes into a tree, and then he must, like, crawl down to the riverbank and is just kind of staring across the river as he dies. And, of course, Walt comes and he tells Walt to, like, shut up and let him die in peace. But, it really gives a sense of this kind of, like, warrior trying to die, like, a lonely and perhaps spiritual death in nature, something that Walt is doing his best to interrupt. But this character was so great, and what were you thinking about as you were playing that scene? What was going through your mind then as Jonathan Banks and as Mike Ehrmantraut?
That was a very difficult day on the set. That was hard to go away from, especially when you think you're never going to do this character again. Mike always knew he was going to die. Always expected that, and I don't think and thought it would be violent. The warrior mentality is let me die with some dignity. You know, they only give us on the show one F-bomb a year, and that's where I got it with the line "Let me die in peace." You're next to the Rio Grande. Now the technicality of it all was we were running out of light. Everybody's hurrying up, and I am supposed to be in this contemplative, serene state as I'm going out. And it was, you know, you had to hold it together. And there's a certain amount of humor in that too, because I had looked for that moment and looked for that moment and waited for that moment, and all of a sudden everybody's running around like their heads are cut off. But between Tom Schnaz, who directed it, and Michael Slovis, who is so good, a cinematographer, I didn't realize that the camera was back up on the hill and they were shooting down towards me. I thought it was a profile, and then I saw it and I just thought it was great.
So Jonathan Banks, you're a former cop in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. You've played a lot of cops and former cops over the years, and in Wise Guy, where I first saw you. How did you get into acting?
I was a handful, and I used to, at the gym at the school, when I'd go out for whatever practice it was, I would look through the gym window, and I'd wanted to do it since I was probably five, with Jimmy Durante and Jackie Gleason, who I just loved. And one day in the hall, Miss Cartwright, who did the plays, yelled at me when I was hanging with some of the boys, and she yelled down the hall and she said, "Banks, you're a chicken." Said, "I've seen you looking through that window for a long time." And she said, "Why don't you ever audition for a play?" And I auditioned for the junior class play, and I got the lead, and we were doing Shaw's The Devil's Disciple, which no high school should ever do, but we did. And it changed my life. My mom was having to work all day long and go to school at night trying to give me a better life. But I was on the street a lot. And that answers some of your questions about the neighborhood or whatever it was. And, you know, when she got her teaching degree, and she then took me to this high school where I got very lucky. Hey, you know what I said, Terry, about being lucky? If I say it 1,000 times more, it's the way I feel. I honestly feel that I am one of the luckiest human beings that ever walked.
I love hearing stories about teachers who, who give students an opportunity that they would have been too embarrassed or shy to ask for, or just wouldn't have thought of doing, and that it's transformative. So,
well,
thanks to that
teacher.
I'll
tell you this.
Yeah.
That teacher, it was one of those things. And then I did it. And of course, back then, you know, there were no computers. I thought there were only the smart kids did it, is what I thought. And I didn't think I belonged there. And they were all walking around with the slide rules in their pocket and all that. And they were so gentle with me. And they were so good to me because I was from somewhere else. I was from somewhere else. And they were dear to me. I look at those kids that, you know, back then were called nerds or whatever. And I couldn't have been treated any better. And there was a trade-off, too, because nobody was ever going to put them in a locker ever again, I can tell you that.
Were you going to protect them?
You bet you.
The roots of Mike. There we have it.
Terry Gross speaking with Jonathan Banks and Peter Gould. Banks co-stars in the Breaking Bad prequel, Better Call Saul. Peter Gould co-created the series. You can download a podcast of that interview, which includes conversation that we didn't have time for in this episode, at itunes.com/freshair. Texas singer-songwriter James McMurtry is known for songs with strong narratives and melodies that are a blend of country, blues, and rock. He's just released his first new studio album since 2008. It's called Complicated Game. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it demonstrates a new range of style and subject matter for McMurtry.
Skies are taller in Louisiana. The skies are wider in New Mexico. The skies in Texas kind of split the difference. They don't suit me no matter where I go. I ain't got a place in this world. I ain't got a place in this world, I know.
Like a lot of singer-songwriters, James McMurtry likes to position himself as an outsider. That's what the song that opens this review, Ain't Got a Place, suggests. A restlessness that finds home ground in songwriting and performing. There is, however, a certain kinship McMurtry has consistently expressed throughout his career, an identification with people who work with their hands, who spend their free time hunting and fishing. It's a kinship described vividly in the song that begins the album, Copper Canteen.
Honey, don't you be yelling at me when I'm cleaning my gun. I'll wash the blood off the tailgate when deer season's done. We got one more weekend to go, and I'd like to kill one more doe. So I'll I'll shovel the sidewalk again, 'cause you're still in a stoop.
That's the tale of a marriage fraught with tension. It's a tension alleviated mostly by the narrator periodically leaving the house to shovel snow or shoot one more deer before either hunting season or the marriage ends. Like quite a few of McMurtry's characters, this man feels at once hemmed in and guilty that he's not doing better for himself and for the people who depend upon him. Like the album title says, it's a complicated game. The most ambitious song on this album is Carlisle's Hall. It's a detailed portrait of a commercial fisherman that opens out into a more universal theme of hopelessness held at bay by the loyalty people feel to each other, even in bad times.
Oh, Carlisle needs some money. He's running a seine out off the point. We'll all go help him though. Commercial season's closed. We might all wind up in the joint.
Over the course of a few decades, McMurtry has frequently seemed to pride himself on singing in a monotone, the better to make you focus on his words. His vocals throughout Complicated Game, however, are more expressive than on any other previous album. You can hear this most strikingly on two songs. The first is a fine piece of blues with a boogie beat called Forgotten Coast, with some slide guitar playing by Derek Trucks.
Down the highway south I'll go. We were hitchhiking to Port St. Joe. I'm gonna walk the beach where the pirate's ghost. And we'll haunt that old forgotten coast. I'm gonna trade my car and change my name. And put Wesson oil in my bar and chain. I'm gonna fix a roadkill black bear roast. And get that on that forgotten coast.
The second song in which McMurtry challenges himself to push past his usual eloquent drawl is How Am I Gonna Find You Now? In a couple of places, I've read McMurtry's vocal on this song referred to as a rap or almost rap or rap singing. But with its generous outpouring of words assembled to mimic the rhythm of a rapid car ride, How Am I Gonna Find You Now has as much to do with Bob Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues and 100 old talking blues songs as it does hip-hop.
I got a cup of black coffee so I don't get lazy. I got a rattle in the dashboard driving me crazy. And if I hit it with my fist, it'll quit for a little while. Gonna have to stop and take a piss in another mile. Headed into town, gonna meet you at the mercantile. Take you to the sun, it gets you grinning like a crocodile.
Complicated Game is a really satisfying collection. For a fellow known as a wordsmith, the album also brings welcome attention to McMurtry's guitar playing, a talent that usually gets greater exposure when you see him live. One of the challenges for a musician who builds his songs around telling stories is to keep those stories interesting after you've listened to them four or five times or more. I'm here to tell you, this music holds up.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed James McMurtry's new album called Complicated Game. Now that spring is near, finally, it's a good time to be thinking of delicious vegetable dishes. Earlier this week, Terry spoke with Jack Bishop and Bridget Lancaster, who work with America's Test Kitchen and have some good tips about how to build flavor in vegetarian dishes. Dishes intended to appeal to meat eaters as well as vegetarians. America's Test Kitchen publishes cookbooks and produces radio and TV shows. Jack Bishop is the editorial director of the Test Kitchen and edited their new book, The Complete Vegetarian Cookbook. Bridget Lancaster is the executive food editor of the Test Kitchen and contributed to the new book. The last time they joined us on Fresh Air, it was to talk about how to buy and prepare meat dishes.
Bridget Lancaster, Jack Bishop, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, I have to tell you, after we did the interview about your meat cookbook, we got some angry responses from just a few listeners who thought that we were basically all monsters for promoting meat eating. And I'm wondering if you get that a lot, and I'm wondering if this vegetarian cookbook is atonement.
I love that. It's kind of our atonement. Jack could probably speak a little bit more to this. I think for myself, you know, as a person who enjoys a good steak, I myself am trying to eat less meat, and on occasion that means coming across a vegetarian meal. And I think I'm not the only one out there. So this book is to appeal to the people that maybe are turning vegetarian, looking for more options, or are vegetarians.
Yeah, Terry, I like to think as a creative collective, which is what America's Test Kitchen is, filled with a lot of strong personalities, and we all are pushing our own agendas at times. I finally won, is how I'm looking at this particular book. This is my turn to get what I want. But seriously, you get a lot of requests for more vegetarian food. And it's interestingly mostly coming from people who eat meat but want to take a break a day a week, 2 days a week, 4 days a week from eating meat and have no idea how to feed themselves, especially when it comes to dinner. I mean, most people are pretty good at breakfast and lunch without meat, but you get to dinner and it gets a lot more complicated.
Jack, you wrote that this is not your mother's vegetarian cooking. So how old is the mother that you're thinking of? And like my mother's vegetarian cooking was largely canned string beans or carrots and peas. So who is the mother that you're thinking of, and how is your cookbook different than that mother's vegetarian cooking?
To be clear, my mother, who no doubt is listening on her public radio station in Miami, at the moment I'm not speaking about my mother, but I'm speaking about mothers in the 1970s, which is when I was a teenager, and I'm thinking about macrobiotic brown rice, you know, that food that didn't look very appealing and it actually tasted even worse, that was the sort of beginning of this idea of thinking about eating in a different way, in a healthier way, but it really didn't work. It was just dull, stodgy, heavy, bland, boring. I mean, I can't think of enough bad adjectives to describe the kind of cooking I'm thinking about from the 1970s.
Okay, well, let's talk about what's in your vegetarian cookbook. Let's start with some flavor builders that you say will give the dishes a meatier flavor. And even though this isn't a meat cookbook, when you say meatier, what do you mean?
Well, I think when we say meaty, we're meaning that really savory flavor that you get from things, of course, like meat. You get it from fish as well. But there are other ingredients out there that have these components. It's umami is the actual taste, or umami, however you pronounce it. And it incites our taste receptors on our tongue to kind of pick up that savory note from foods. So mushrooms, which, you know, my parents, when I was growing up, they would tell me, you know, to eat more mushrooms because it tasted like meat. Well, they already know what we know now is that it has that meaty, the glutamates, the flavor compounds that give off that meaty flavor. Tomatoes are another thing. They're naturally high in glutamates, so they give a meaty flavor. And then when you take tomatoes and, of course, you cook them down, you concentrate them into tomato paste, just a little bit is enough to really add that savory richness to foods. And I think as a whole, a lot of vegetarian foods, especially a while back, were kind of one-dimensional. They were a little bit sweet or a little bit bitter. Especially our main courses in this cookbook really satisfy a lot more of the flavors on our palate. You've got the savory, you've got the sweet, the bitter, you've got the salty. And I think that's what makes things taste more satisfactory, or, you know, leaves you satisfied after a meal.
Surprise us with something that you would put some tomato puree in to give it that savory flavor that we, I know, a dish that we wouldn't associate with tomato.
I think a great example is an Indian curry. So you don't really think, if there are no chunks of tomatoes, that it doesn't have tomatoes in it. But often we'll add, after we've browned onions and garlic, and if it's a curry, we've added some ginger, we might add a tablespoon or two of tomato paste and brown that briefly to bring out its flavor. And the tomato paste, because it's got all the liquid cooked out of it, has a really intense umami, savory flavor. There are a lot of glutamates in it. And then you go ahead and you add the water. You can add the coconut milk. And it isn't you know, there are no chunks of tomatoes per se. I'm thinking about a recipe in the book with potatoes and cauliflower and peas, and it's not a tomato curry per se. But there is a tablespoon of tomato paste in there that's providing backbone, structure to the dish, and really depth. And you probably wouldn't identify it in the finished dish, but leave it out and you would notice the difference.
So let me ask you about mushrooms. If you're using mushrooms for the savory flavor that it's going to give to whatever it is you're cooking, do you need to saute them first to kind of bring out the flavor, to release the flavor?
I think sometimes you would want to saute them, but we do have a couple of applications where we grind up mushrooms and we use them almost as a ground, quote unquote, meat. Things like our vegetarian chili. We have a vegetarian chili that not only uses ground mushrooms, but also ground walnuts for a similar kind of rich ground meat texture. And those are, of course, they're just lightly sautéed in the chili, so they don't get that really, really dark flavor. But, you know, you're just really concentrating the flavor more than anything. So we do use mushrooms in several different applications.
So in talking more about how to develop flavor in vegetarian dishes, you rely a lot on soy sauce. So what does soy sauce contribute?
So soy sauce is one of those ingredients that is also umami-packed. It has lots of those glutamates in it. So it's a power ingredient when you're talking about vegetarian cooking. Very similar to mushrooms, you add a little bit and it's going to give that meaty, savory flavor. And, you know, the surprising thing is that you don't have to just use it for stir fries or other types of Asian dishes. We use it as a seasoning. So you can use it in soup, meatballs, all sorts of things. Anytime that we want to get, of course, meatballs without meat. And we use it anytime that we really want to give that deeper flavor.
So when you're using it to season, as opposed to like using it directly on your food, are you using just like a really little bit of it?
Yes, you are using just a little bit, really. There's maybe a couple teaspoons or a tablespoon that would go into an entire dish.
Yeah, Terry, a favorite recipe of mine is a mushroom bolognese sauce. So bolognese is the traditional Italian meat sauce that's made with ground pork, ground veal, ground beef, where as you're sautéing the ingredients, you add a little bit of tomato paste and some soy sauce.
Oh.
I think it's a tablespoon of soy sauce. And you would think, soy sauce in an Italian recipe? And it doesn't read as soy sauce in the final dish. But again, it's adding more depth than if you were to just add an equivalent amount of salt. All you're really getting is salt. But if you add soy sauce, you get salt and you get the glutamates, which are the things that stimulate the taste receptors on your tongue. There are actually five tastes that we can perceive. You know, when I went to school, there were four. There's sweet and sour and bitter and salty. Those were the four that I learned. But the scientists have now agreed that there is a fifth receptor, which is this umami savory receptor, which glutamates activate. And they send these little signals to our brain that say savory, satisfying, robust, you know, things like nuts have a lot of the same characteristics. And that's how they activate that part of our taste buds, mushrooms. And soy sauce does that in a very direct, sort of concentrated way.
You use a lot of broths for vegetarian cooking. And you actually, and I'm glad to hear this, recommend a couple of store-bought broths so that we don't have to start from scratch to cook the broths. Do you want to recommend a couple of your favorites?
Sure. There are actually three favorites I'm going to give to you. One is Orrington Farms. It's actually a vegan chicken-flavored broth, and that's a base and seasoning. So you can just use a little bit at a time and reconstitute it to make your broth. And then there's Swanson, which has a certified organic vegetable broth. Both of these are so much better than a lot of other store-bought broths out there because they can tend to taste, I think that they often taste too much like celery, or they taste too much like carrot, or too much really like nothing. And then when you go to make your own, making your own is easy, but it can be time-consuming if you really want to get that balanced flavor. The third option, though, we have actually come up with our own base. And I was a skeptic of this because I didn't think that there could be anything that was easy that would end up being so good, especially in terms of vegetarian cooking. But it's a broth base that we make. You take your food processor out and you grind up some ingredients. There's carrots, of course, go in there. Instead of celery, we added celery root, which has a much milder flavor. has, instead of onions, which can be a little bit overpowering, we put in leeks, which have that nice, softer flavor. It also has a little bit of a buttery texture. And then we've got salt. The salt does two things to this mixture. It's obviously going to season it, but it also, you know how you would add salt or you would freeze ice cream with salt around it to keep it from freezing up solid? We add salt to this, and it keeps the texture so that it's scoopable because we're going to grind up all these ingredients, including the celery root, the carrots, leeks. There's soy sauce in there again, going back to the umami. There's tomato paste. And you would mix that with the salt. There's some dried minced onion, and put it in your freezer in a jar. It stays in there for up to 6 months, but the best thing is all you need to do is go in there with a tablespoon measure, scoop out a tablespoon, and add it to a cup of boiling water, and you've got instant vegetable broth. So the whole prep takes maybe 10 minutes to do. You put it in your freezer, and it's there whenever you need it.
Jack, do you ever make vegetarian burgers?
I do, and I've sort of changed my mind recently about these. I think the store-bought ones are not an advertisement for eating or making vegetarian burgers. They're just very sad. I mean, I feel like, you know, you've got a vegetarian coming over for a summer barbecue and you go get, you know, a store-bought brand and it's just has no flavor, no real texture.
I think of them as a photocopy of a beef burger.
Twice removed.
Yes, exactly. Almost there. Looks like it, but that's it.
We developed about a half dozen different burger recipes. My favorite contains pinto beans, beets, and bulgur. And it's got such great flavor. And what I really love is the texture. So bulgur is a type of wheat. It cooks really, really quickly. And it gives it kind of that nubbiness that you expect, whether it's a turkey burger or a beef burger. You get kind of some of that nubbiness from it. The shredded raw beets, they add a little bit of like creaminess to it. They add some sweetness to it. They add some nice flavor.
They add the right color too.
They add the right color. There's a little bit of ground walnuts, which again adds some savory notes. You don't really say, oh, these have walnuts in them when you're tasting them. And then the best part is you serve them with sriracha mayonnaise, homemade version with some, you can use store-bought mayonnaise and just add some sriracha sauce if you like. And it's just absolutely wonderful burger, super flavorful, and it looks pretty, it eats well. If you've got a vegetarian who's coming over, he or she will be very happy with their burger. And in fact, probably the people who are eating the meat will want to eat the vegetarian burgers.
In honor of spring, which I hear is going to arrive soon, do you have a favorite salad that you want to recommend?
I have one. It's a salad with crispy spiced chickpeas and a honey mustard vinaigrette. And what I love about this is the original goal for this was to make a salad with an analog to bacon. You know, I'm thinking about a wilted spinach salad that has a warm bacon vinaigrette. And we said in the kitchen, could we do something similar but use chickpeas? And so we fry them in a little bit of oil, shallow fry them, and then they're tossed with smoked paprika, a spice you can get now in every supermarket. And it gives them nice color, gives them a little bit of smokiness, a little bit of cumin, a little bit of sugar, and cayenne. And then all of the other things, has some charred red onion, just sliced red onion that goes underneath the broiler. You can do it with arugula, with spinach. I mean, the lettuce is sort of up to you. You toss these crunchy, spicy, crispy chickpeas with really beautiful lettuce. You've got some tender charred red onion, this honey mustard vinaigrette. It's a fabulous salad.
The only problem with that salad is the chickpeas never make it into the salad when I make it. They're so good. And they do give you that crunch that you would get with something like a bacon, you know, crumbled bacon over the top. But yeah, that salad ends up just being about onions and lettuce.
You're
just
snacking
don't tell my
along
guests.
The way.
Exactly. Don't tell my guests about the chickpeas.
So any advice to parents who want their children to eat vegetables and want their children to enjoy eating vegetables?
My first thing is to roast the vegetable rather than boil or simmer it. When you roast the vegetable, two really good things happen. Number one, you get all of that browning, and browning equals flavor. And so you bring out the sweetness, it caramelizes a little bit. I'm thinking about broccoli. I don't boil or simmer or steam broccoli. I roast it. I just cut it up into sort of 1.5-inch florets, toss it with some olive oil and salt, throw it on a sheet pan lined with foil for easy cleanup, 10, 12 minutes in a 500-degree oven, and it's done. And that really works. Cauliflower, sweet potatoes, I mean, whatever.
Asparagus.
Mm-hmm. Green beans, they all can be roasted. And so I think the other thing it does is it makes them the texture a little bit, you get crunchy bits.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's almost, you get these little bits of broccoli that almost seem like they're fried a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, be generous with the olive oil. I mean, I would not think that 1 teaspoon of olive oil for a head of broccoli, that's not going to work. You're going to need 2 or 3 tablespoons of olive oil. It'll not only make it taste better, but you'll get some little crispy bits. Put really good salt on. I use a nice coarse sea salt right at the table for a little bit more impact, and it is the best side dish.
So what you're doing is kind of doing you're doing a slight imitation of a French fry.
A very slight. And I think if you try to sell it that way, it's not going to work to most children. But it's that same idea of, you know, brown tastes better. You get more interesting textures. Cauliflower, all the squashes, you know, butternut squash, sweet potatoes, you know.
My kids request this done with broccoli all the time. If I told people at my kids' school that they are broccoli fiends, they would think that they're crazy. But they love this method done with broccoli.
Okay.
And then a dipping sauce afterwards is great, too. You can have a little bit of sesame seeds that you sprinkle over the broccoli or the cauliflower or squash. And then they dip them in a little bit of like a sesame oil. It's so tasty.
Bridget Lancaster is the executive food editor of America's Test Kitchen and contributed to the new book, The Complete Vegetarian Cookbook, which was edited by the Test Kitchen's editorial director, Jack Bishop. You'll find the original podcast of that interview, which includes cooking tips and recipes that we couldn't squeeze into today's episode, at itunes.com/freshair. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.B. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.